I love the buildings and the pavement and the malls. I love the fact.
We now join the BBC World Service in progress. We now join the BBC World Service in progress here on CFRU.
Some political prisoners are released in Belarus, but the EU is stepping up pressure for reform there. The new idea is to stop gang violence in Britain's inner cities, and the creator of some of the cinema's most famous music dies.
His music would be in your house, and it'd be with your family, and then it'd be on the radio, and it'd be in your head, and then it was in your heart. You know, it kind of got everywhere, and it's been hugely influential on so many people over the years.
That's coming up on Europe Today after the news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. The President of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, has sworn in a new cabinet, as demonstrators in Cairo continue to demand his resignation. The most noticeable change is the replacement of the unpopular Interior Minister, Habib al-Adli. Shahzeb Jilani has the details.
As the head of Egypt's internal security force, Mr. Adli was widely despised by anti-government protesters for what they described as police brutality. He's now been replaced by a retired police officer, Mahmoud Wajdi. The finance minister, Yusuf Boutros Ghali, has also lost his job as concern grows about the impact of a week of protests on the economy. But will the latest reshuffle go some way to satisfy the demonstrators? Many protesters say not until Mr. Mubarak is himself removed from power.
The authorities in Egypt have announced that all flights run by Egyptian airlines are being cancelled during curfew hours, that is, from 3 in the afternoon to 8 the following morning. Train services are also being stopped. The news came after protesters called for 1 million people to march through Cairo on Tuesday. The demonstrators are out in force again today.
I want that Mubarak is out, the parliament is down, and we have something free. This is the first time for me. I am 38 years old, and for the first time to be in a crowd like this. We are all from every place in Egypt. I am coming from Alexandria.
We want a just ruler. We want Mubarak out. Mubarak has corrupted political life, social life, economic life.
Police officers have been ordered to return to the streets in parts of Cairo after being withdrawn last week. Thousands of foreign nationals caught up in the anti-government protests in Egypt have been trying to flee from the unrest. A BBC correspondent just landed at Cairo's international airport, said he could see armed troops being marched in and people in large numbers trying to get seats on flights that have been overbooked. A number of countries, including the United States, Britain, China and Japan, have organised special charter flights to evacuate their citizens. Indonesia said it was sending military transport aircraft to bring its citizens home. Anti-government protesters in Sudan have held further demonstrations.
Hi folks. This is Taryn Forma, and we've got a half hour of environmental news from coast to coast coming your way. My name's Steve Anderson, and I'm your host for Terra Informa this week. Today we hear from the Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society, who explain why it's important that we move to protect 50% of the country from development. Certainly a lofty goal, but is it realistic? Well, stay tuned for more on that one. We also hear from several people who are involved in different aspects of the sustainable agriculture movement, and we'll take a look at more environmentally friendly methods of cremation. But as always, we start things off with the news. Here's Rebecca Rooney and Sheila Payton with your rundown of the week's headlines.
Thanks, Steve. We start things off today in Ontario, where green electricity provider Bullfrog Power has won a jackpot with the Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corporation. The corporation already owns 7 locations that subscribe to Bullfrog Power, but on January 20th, they also signed up the slots at the Woodbine Racetrack in Toronto. Bullfrog Power will now cover its nearly 12,000 megawatt hours of annual electricity consumption using 100% green sources. With this new contract, the Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corporation becomes the largest Canadian supporter of renewable energy from Bullfrog Power. The Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corporation will now be greening 35,000 megawatt hours of electricity annually, enough to power over 3,800 Canadian homes. Bullfrog Power is a national company that provides certified renewable electricity to homes and businesses. In Ontario, their electricity comes entirely from wind and hydro facilities.
So how far do you think you could swim? Could you imagine swimming for 9 days straight? News from our northern region this week details the amazing journey of a female polar bear recorded swimming for 9 days. The U.S. Geological Survey released a report this week recording her 700-kilometer swim through the Beaufort Sea. She then continued her trek for another 1,800 kilometers, mainly swimming but occasionally encountering sea ice substantial enough for her to walk on. While this news was inspiring to the zoologists involved in the study, it also depicted the costs of such a journey. The bear lost 22% of her body weight, as well as her one-year-old cub died on the voyage. This news is no surprise to Andrew Durocher, one of Canada's top polar bear scientists, who says that this year, ice is particularly low in the eastern Arctic. This means polar bears may take a big hit since they may not have access to their main food source, seals. According to Durocher, polar bears can cope with 1 year of bad ice, but if the ice does not increase next year, there will be significant losses in the populations.
It was a big week for the Nature Conservancy of Canada, who, jointly with the federal government, have announced the acquisition of 4 additional conservation easements nearby Riding Mountain National Park in Manitoba, and another acquisition of land on the Bay of Fundy near Moncton, New Brunswick. The Manitoban properties secured by the Nature Conservancy of Canada represent pieces of one of the last remaining ecologically functioning landscapes in Prairie Canada. The properties include a mix of forest and grassland, and at a net cost of less than $168,000, they add about 330 hectares of valuable habitat to the 50 properties previously secured by the Conservancy in the Riding Mountain Aspen Parkland region. This is equivalent to about 5 quarter sections of land. The Riding Mountain Aspen Parkland is home to many of Manitoba's large mammals, including the Riding Mountain gray wolf, elk, moose, American black bear, and cougar. The quaking aspen and white spruce forest stands provide homes for many species of grassland birds and other waterfowl. The habitat is also home to several at-risk species, including the loggerhead shrike, golden-winged warbler, and red-headed woodpecker. The New Brunswick acquisition included about 4 hectares of mudflats and tidal marsh that are an important stopover site for North American shorebirds. Over 2 million shorebirds stop to feed in the bay's rich mudflats on their winter migration from the Canadian Arctic to South America. During this stopover, the birds must double their weight in order to survive the remainder of their migration. They do this by gorging on abundant mud shrimp that live in the mudflats. Each bird will eat between 10 and 20,000 mud shrimp per low tide. The influx of shorebirds attract the predatory peregrine falcon, a species of special concern in Canada. Peter Hicklin is a shorebird biologist who studies at the shorebird reserve lands protected by the Nature Conservancy. He has found that as the peregrine falcon recovers, the mean weight of shorebirds in the area is declining.
The way that it's worked in the past is they arrive here in the low 20s, 21 to 24 grams, and they should double their weight in about 10 days. That was the way it was prior to the return of peregrine falcons, which are clearly much healthier than they were 10 years ago.
With the newly secured shoreline, the Nature Conservancy now protects nearly 200 hectares of shorebird reserve land in New Brunswick, providing more habitat for shorebirds to feed and for scientists to research them.
In BC this week, the Save Mary Lake fundraising campaign was in high gear. Here, local resident and environmental activist Bob McMinn explains why Mary Lake is important.
It's particularly important for the Greater Victoria area because it forms the missing link in a trail that CID had long hoped for between Thetis Lake Park and the Gowland Provincial Park. Making this link will allow a circle right round the highlands of about 20 to 25 kilometres of trail. And the property itself is part of the endangered dry coastal Douglas fir system, of which only about 6% is in permanently protected. So let's hope we're not going to lose any of this.
The estimated cost for protecting the lake is $1 million. And the campaign has taken an innovative approach to fundraising using a variety of social media such as Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. They have modeled their fundraiser after the Save an Acre of Rainforest programs from the 1980s. They have divided the lake into square meters that you can sponsor on their website. Here, Bill McMinn explains how it works.
Using social media and text donations, charities have raised $500,000 in an hour, and political campaigns have pulled in millions. How long would it take you to get four people in your life to save a square meter of Mary Lake? An hour? A day? Could 25,000 of us do this today?
To date, the campaign has saved almost 17,000 meters squared. To find out more information about Mary's Lake or to find out how to donate, visit the links on our website at terrainforma.ca.
That about wraps it up for this week's summary of news headlines. Back over to you, Steve.
Thanks, Rebecca. That was, of course, Rebecca Rooney and Sheila Payton with your Terra Informa news headlines. Canada has about 10% of its land under some form of environmental protection, and much of that's due to the advocacy work of conservation organizations. One of those groups is the Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society, who tell us they won't rest until 50% of the country is protected. It sounds like a lot, so we got their national director on the phone from Ottawa to explain their mission. Here's Eric Hébert-Daly in conversation with our correspondent Dave Cotchin. They got things rolling with a bit of politics.
What do you see as the Conservative government's biggest achievement in terms of conservation and their biggest failing?
There's no question in my mind that the creation of some major and significantly sizable national parks has been this government's greatest achievement. The Nahanni National Park Reserve in the Northwest Territories, or the identification of new sites like the South Okanagan or Sable Island or Bowen Island, there is an eagerness to identify them and to move them to protection. Where the government could always do better, I think, particularly on the marine side, where less than 0.8% of the longest coastline in the world is protected. That's certainly a failing.
Let's talk a bit about your organization, Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society. Your stated aim is a 50% protection of Canada's natural environment. Certainly sounds like a lot. Some people might balk at that. What kind of protection are we talking about? What level of protection and exclusion do you advocate for?
It may sound like a lot, but the reality is that most people see that as a pretty balanced approach. We're not simply saying that all development should end tomorrow and that everything that is currently wild should remain that way. But there is a balance to be had, and nature needs half. Nature needs to be able to recover. It has to be the right 50%. You know, we can't just be picking postage stamps in a checkerboard style around the country. They have to be interconnected areas. They have to be well managed. But there's no question that that 50% may sound like a lot, but the reality is it's quite reasonable.
How did you choose 50%?
Well, there have been a number of scientists who've worked with us on our conservation vision over the last number of years. And so when you look at both the contribution that Canada needs to make to the international community in terms of being able to protect sizable chunks of nature, we have the opportunity to be able to do that. So we're currently at about 10% of our land protected. So there's a gap to go, obviously. But we have to understand in the context of not only our international commitment, but also in terms of what nature actually needs to be sustainable and to be able to give us the ecosystem services that we've been counting on for a number of years.
How do you manage your relationship with First Nations communities? For instance, resource development often brings jobs to remote areas. How do you manage that conflict between locking up areas against resource exploitation and the needs to provide jobs to people in those areas?
Well, that's one of the key reasons why when we start a conservation campaign in a particular region, that we sit down with all the players and make sure that that we're hearing not only from local communities and First Nations who obviously have an economic interest in those areas. First Nations, for the most part, we have been working very, very closely with CPAWS in a number of our different campaigns, largely because they have an economic interest, but they also very much have an environmental interest as well. Whether it's the sustainability of caribou herds or sustainable fisheries, you see this important balance that, that we talk about is reflected very often in First Nation communities.
Okay. On a different topic, can you tell us a bit about how progress is with regard to protecting threatened species? Is the list of threatened species in Canada growing or shrinking?
No, it's growing. It's growing. There's no question. We see a lot of our iconic species in some serious danger.
So is it a matter of protecting new areas or managing the current protected areas better?
It's absolutely both. There's no question that you have to be able to manage the protected areas in a way that is reasonable and responsible. But connecting them is also quite important.
So it's not just a matter of declaring the national park. That's not the end of the battle. It's also about how you manage the national park.
It has to be more than that. Absolutely.
If you had to pick one place in Canada which is currently unprotected that you would very much like to see protected, perhaps your legacy as executive director of CPAWS, what is that one place that you hope to see protected?
Boy, you're asking me to pick from many children. When you look at a place like the Flathead Valley in the southeast corner of British Columbia, it's one of these rare areas in the southern part of our country that is a key connecting point to our mountain park ecosystem. And it's currently not protected. The mining threat is now gone, but there's still, a number of other threats in that landscape. But being able to connect a protected area from Glacier National Park in the U.S. into the Rocky Mountain Park ecosystem, that connectivity is so important in light of climate change, and it's certainly a campaign in an area that we've been working on for a number of years, and I'd love to see protected.
So the Flathead Valley, a personal favourite of yours.
It is, absolutely.
Eric Hebert, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks for that, Dave. You're tuned in to Terra Informa, your source for environmental news. Don't forget, you can also find us online at terrainforma.ca, or you can swing by our Facebook page. It's known as the last bonfire. Over half of Canadians today choose to be cremated rather than buried. But the process has come under fire. Cremation consumes huge amounts of electricity and produces about 400 kilograms of carbon dioxide per ignition. However, new techniques of cremation may redeem its sooty reputation. This week, Brett Taggart looks at what's involved in green cremation and how it has kindled a new way to look at death.
I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart.
With a growing awareness of climate change, people are increasingly searching for ways to make their final resting place a more environmentally friendly one. More than half of Canadians choose to be cremated, which goes a long way toward reducing the land loss to graveyards. But cremation itself has enormous short-term costs. Each cremation consumes as much energy, in the form of natural gas and electricity, as a coast-to-coast car trip. The emissions from the cremation average around 400 kilograms of carbon dioxide, along with other pollutants like dioxins and heavy metals. However, a new method of cremation is being introduced in an Ottawa funeral parlor, alkaline hydrolysis, one of the new techniques called biocremation that aim to reduce the energy cost and emissions of a conventional cremation. In alkaline hydrolysis, the body is submerged in water in a stainless steel chamber. Heat, pressure, and potassium hydroxide, the key ingredient in soap, are added to dissolve the tissue. 2 hours later, all that's left is bone residue and a sterile liquid that can be disposed of safely. The bones can be crushed and returned to the family as with cremation. CO2 emissions are cut by almost 90%, electricity by two-thirds, and heavy metals can be recovered intact and recycled. Alkaline hydrolysis has encountered some resistance from religious institutions in the United States who claim the process is disrespectful to human dignity. It also has clashed with local authorities concerned with water safety. However, another new cremation technique does not produce even this small amount of pollutant. Cryomation. Cryomation involves using liquid nitrogen to freeze the body, then vibrating it until the brittle body is reduced to dust. After the water and nitrogen has been evaporated, the dust can be screened for heavy metals and then be buried in the soil, ideally under a plant or tree. Cryomation produces zero air pollution and uses significantly less energy than even alkaline hydrolysis. The end result of the process is fully biodegradable and returns the nutrients in our bodies to the soil in a manner similar to natural burial. After nearly a decade of trials and ethical challenges, the first cryomatorium will open in Sweden next April. This will be closely followed by South Korea, which is building at least 13 crematoriums across the country to accommodate the burial method on a larger scale. South Korea has faced problems of limited land and crowded graveyards for years, and cryomation proposes a safe route out of their dilemma. Suzanne Wee-Masak, the biologist who pioneered the method, says that cryomation will be the future solution for Korea, and that the traditional burials as they are today may not be allowed in the future there. Canada may not face the same shortage of land, but we do have a reputation for embracing green alternatives. The image of nourishing a tree after your death is comforting, and it provides a much more impressive monument to mark your final resting place. And as the Canadian tradition for cremation stretches all the way back to the cremation of Sam McGee, so it will stretch forward to a greener future.
Thanks, Brett. For anyone just joining us, I'm your host Steve Anderson, and you're listening to Terra Informa. Well, for those of you who are getting a little stir-crazy waiting for spring to arrive, this next piece is for you. About a year ago, the University of Guelph hosted a conference on sustainable agriculture. This is a piece we did at the time, highlighting some of the most interesting talks that took place. On November 20th, supporters of urban agriculture gathered at the University of Guelph. They were there to share their knowledge and their stories about backyard gardening, urban farming, and everything in between. Speakers included farmers, academics, and activists, and each person shared a different perspective. But one theme that seemed to run through all of the presentations was the sense of community that gardening creates. Today we're going to hear some short excerpts from a few of the speakers. We'll begin with Sri Sethuratnam. He has 20 years' experience in farming, a master's degree from the University of Guelph, and is currently the project manager for FarmStart. FarmStart is an organization that works to encourage people to take up farming. Their goal is economically viable, locally based, and environmentally sound agriculture. Here's Sri to tell us about the experiences of some of the people his group has helped to get started.
This is a snapshot of our farmers, and I have tons of stories. Like, I can talk for years the stories I've had over this season working with our farmers. But before I go into that, I just, with Karen's permission, want to quote from something she had written, in which she says, it's tough to get young people interested in farming because those raised on a farm know about the economic challenges and those raised in the city don't know where to begin. And I'll go through my farmers with you and then come back to that statement. So that's Matchbox, a group of young Canadians, three of them, very dynamic, farmed. Actually, she was growing plants in a box in her backyard. And that's how she got the word Matchbox. And she was selling seeds. And she scaled up. Last year was the first year for Hannah. She did 3 acres this year, felt it was too much. She's scaling down to 2 acres next year. On the right-hand side is Cutting Wedge. Daniel, one of our best farmers, very innovative, runs a 50-member CSA, grows 1 acre of garlic, and he grows garlic from 7 different countries, Poland, Ukraine. And he sells it as such. From those countries. On the bottom is one of our, so those are the young Canadian farmers. On the bottom is Bob, not very young Canadian immigrant from Pakistan. He started last year, and I know his story from day number one because I was involved with him. He started last year on 3 rows, and this year he did 1 acre. That's his father-in-law next to him, a very interesting man, farmed for 30 years in Pakistan on 50 acres of land, came to help his son-in-law. Probably that's the first time the father-in-law is helping the son-in-law from those parts. So that's Bob. So again, another snapshot of our farmers. Cheng, whom you see on the left-hand side, is from northern China. And a classic example of that you don't need any language to farm. It's a language of the heart. He can't speak English. His English knowledge is only about 20%. And half the time we've communicated by writing. And when the communication has become complicated, I write and then he writes. He can read and write. And he's erected that hoop house or sort of greenhouse 50 meters by 10 meters all on his own. I don't know where he got the network for that. He started mushrooms. He lost $2,000 worth of mushrooms. But he's still at it. I sent him to a mushroom grower in Ottawa, and he's gone and got advice from him. On the top is Lewis. He's doing bees. And I ask him, you know, what happens if someone goes close by and they get stung by a bee? He says, there's no harm. It's good to get stung once in a way. He's from Philippines, grown on a bee farm all his life. And when he came to us last year, he was on the top of things. Again, a new immigrant, probably 2-3 years in Canada. He had done all his research, gone out, contacted bee farmers. All he needed was winter management. And he's done that this year. He actually didn't sell his produce because he had two hives. And he said, if I sell this now, I'm going to make disgruntled customers because I know my honey is good and people will come back to me and I'm not going to be able to satisfy the demand. So that's the sort of attitude he is in. On the bottom is Margaret and Rodney. Margaret is from Zimbabwe. Rodney is from Trinidad. I actually don't know why she actually farms. She's probably in a job which is paying her $40,000 in downtown Toronto. But she wants to be involved in a safe food system. Started the season not knowing where her market was at all. And I was very apprehensive that she was not going to make it. But she like gathered steam. She cooked her own vegetables and gave to her friends and got the market through that. Sold at the church which she goes to. And she's up and running. Next year she's doing 2 acres.
That was Sheree Sethuratnam speaking in Guelph at Opportunities for Action, an urban agriculture symposium. Another speaker was Paul Winstanley. He worked for years to improve the City of Victoria's bylaw support for urban farming. One of his tactics included raising 100 chickens on unused land near Victoria City Hall. Here, he gives a few tips for anyone looking to get a start at urban agriculture.
In terms of helping people to get over, to feel they have a green thumb, to make sure that when you start a garden, if it's your first garden or you're helping someone get their first garden start, start it small. You can have it big, but start one location where you've really got the soil is excellent because you find out about soil, you find out about tilth and loam and how humus works and all that, and you have one location where it's really good soil and it's really deep dug. And then the key thing is watering. And watering, what I find is people make deep beds, but they're mounded. Instead, it should be this way because the water runs off. So if you plant things in a furrow, plant them in a ditch. So the water will always go take their tap root down deep, and that makes them more drought resistant. If you're planting a plant like a cucumber or a tomato or a larger plant, plant it in a dish. Make it concave so that when you're running along watering, you can actually just fill that one up, fill that one up, fill that one up, fill that one up, and then come back. Because another key thing is if you are out there watering and you think, okay, the water's running off, I've given it tons of water, just put your finger in the dirt and you'll see you've watered it that much. And what you can get is you can get, looks like stupendous growth because you've got lots of plants growing, their roots are all here, but that means they're competing with each other. And what you really want to do is drag the roots down deep. So water less often, but give it lots of water. And that has to do with drainage and other things. You might want to go drip irrigation. But mulch, of course, is a key thing to avoid that. But another key thing, as I say, it's just really simple, is try to make your, if you have walkways, put boards down. Make everything flat and put boards. Walk on the boards. And then that traps slugs. The roots can go underneath it. Stops soil from getting compacted. And everything then is flat. So you do, and if you have a slope, well, then definitely be aware of the fact that water is going straight down. The other key thing is in the spring, as soon as the rain stops, you have to start watering deeply right away because it's not just evaporation, but there's osmosis. When the water table goes down, it sucks the water down. So in June or July, you may find that you really need to start heavy watering, even though it might be drizzling rain. It might seem like a lot of rain, but it's actually only moisturizing that much.
That was Paul Winstanley. To finish up, we'll hear from Karen Landman. She's an associate professor in landscape architecture at the University of Guelph and has traveled all across North America visiting urban farms, university research farms, and community gardens. She shared stories about many of the people she met and the projects they're working on, including this one about a farmer from Saskatoon.
Now we're jumping to Saskatoon. This is Wally Satsiewicz. You may have heard of spin farming. Wally is a spin farmer extraordinaire. here he is selling his produce at the beautiful new Saskatoon Farmers Market. And SPIN stands for Small Plot Intensive, and it's done in other people's backyards. Wally and Gail's urban farm is dispersed over 25 residential backyard plots that they rent from homeowners.